ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ॐ नमो वासुदेवाय
श्रीमद्भागवतम् फर्स्ट कैंटो चैप्टर 7 द सन ऑफ द्रोण पनिश्ड टेक्स्ट 41 अथोपेजस्वशिभिरम् Govinda Priya Sarati Navedayatam Priyayai Shochantya Atmajan Hatan Atan Thereafter Upeja Having reached Sa Om Shivaram Camp Govinda, one who enlivens the senses, Lord Shri Krishna. Priya, dear, Sarati, the charioteer, Nyavedayat, entrusted to, Tam, him, Priyaya, unto the dear, Shochantyaya, lamenting for, Atmaja, own sons, Hatan, murder. After reaching his own camp, Arjuna, along with his dear friend and charioteer, Shri Krishna, entrusted the murderer unto his dear wife, who was lamenting for her murdered sons. Purport. The transcendental relation of Arjuna with Krishna is of the dearmost friendship. In the Bhagavad Gita, the Lord himself has claimed Arjuna as his dearmost friend. Every living being is thus related with the Supreme Lord by some sort of affectionate relation, either as servant, or as friend, or as parent, or as an object of conjugal love. Everyone thus can enjoy the company of the Lord in the spiritual realm, if he at all desires, and sincerely tries for it by the process of bhakti yoga. Om Gyanatimidandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshuram Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasavi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Krishna is instigating a intense decision here. Of course, Ashwatthama has caused such a heinous, abominable discussion by his killing of the 5 sleeping babies of Draupadi. Now the question is, what to do? Ashwatthama is the son of Dronacharya, the military teacher of great fame, who also taught Arjuna himself. Yet because the way the battle of Kurukshetra went, Dronacharya had to fight on the other side against the Pandavas. He and Bhishma Dev and others were maintained by the Kauravas, Duryodhana, and so they felt a sense of duty and obligation. We know all is not right on this side, but what can be done? We have our obligations. Now, Dronacharya's son has done such an abominable thing. And Arjuna, remember, had promised his wife, when I catch him, the perpetrator of this abominable deed, I'll cut off his head. And you can take your bath standing on his head. In other words, Arjuna understands his obligations as a grihastha and as a kshatriya to give protection. And he's phrasing that protection in a way appropriate for the situation. The situation is very intensely emotional. You can imagine a mother who's had her five sleeping little boys beheaded with such horror. So Arjuna rises to the occasion with integrity, nobility, and firmness in action. I will personally take responsibility for apprehending this criminal. And this is what his punishment is going to be. This is going to be the resolution. He states that resolution in such dramatic terms. In other words, law and order has to be there. Innocent persons should feel secure and protected. Something has to be done, and this is what will be done. The decisiveness, this decisiveness of Arjuna, is inspiring. Now, Ashwatthama is caught. And again, Arjuna understands how to deal with the main person who has been wronged, Draupadi. He brings Ashwatthama in captivity to their camp, the Pandavas' camp, and he presents the murderer to his dear wife. Here he is. I caught him just like I said he would. Law and order and justice has to be maintained. The principles of Dharma have to be upheld. And the duty and responsibility of Kshatriyas is to make it clear to people that indeed crime doesn't pay. That indeed there'll be a price exacted from you if you disrupt Dharma. So it's not some kind of false ego that Arjuna is that's causing him to act in this way, some kind of revenge. Okay, you took out some of our family members, we're going to take out some of your family members. Like some kind of feud between clans. It's not exactly like that. Sometimes people misunderstand the battle of Kurukshetra as some family feud in which each side is vowing to take out the other side. That's not the depth of the situation. The depth of the situation is about Dharma, the upholding the principles, the eternal principles of progressive human civilization. And there's also the fact that regardless of the wrongs that Duryodhana and company did to the Pandavas, Krishna didn't like them. Now, what's the story with this? Krishna didn't like that the Kauravas, led by Duryodhana, would run the government. You might say, well, what business of that? How is that Krishna's affair? Why? If we accept that there's a supreme personality of Godhead, what is he doing, rolling up his sleeves in these affairs, getting involved? Why is it that he's favoring Arjuna and the Pandavas, and Krishna not so inclined toward Duryodhana and his side? Isn't this favoritism? Hiranyakashipu presents this vision of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in the seventh canto. He's very angry that Vishnu has killed his brother Hiranyaksha. And so Hiranyakashipu takes a vow, I'll kill Vishnu. When the Vishnu's blood flows, that'll be very pleasing to my dead brother Hiranyaksha, who was so fond of drinking blood. Hiranyakashipu, the leader of the demons, and his fellows accepted that there is a supreme controller. They did accept that. They weren't like atheists of today. But they just thought the supreme controller doesn't know what he's doing. He's always favoring the demigods just because they give him offerings. And that way the supreme controller comes under the influence of the offerings of the demigods. They bribe him. It was a Mahaprasad. They bribe him. He always sticks up for them. In that way, you can understand actually Vishnu is fickle and irresolute. And we demons have to suffer the consequences of such fickleness. But that's all going to change. Hiranyakashipu announced, it'll all change when I finish off Vishnu. It will stop all this fickleness, this imbalance of proper dealings in the universe. It was a very interesting situation, very interesting psychology, in that these big demons, like Hiranyakashipu, accepted that Vishnu exists. He's the leader of the demigods. He's always under their thumb. That way so many problems are caused. Today, a substantial amount of people think that religion causes problems. This God stuff, it causes strife, it causes so much violence. Better to rid society of all religion, and that will minimize all the wars. For example, I was looking at one survey taken in Japan where it said, over 90% of the people in Japan think that their society is superior because religion plays very little role. Over 90%. And that they believe that religion simply causes clashes, strifes, problems. Some years ago, some so-called religious group spread poison gas in the subway system. That's what religion does. So therefore, better to do without. Now you notice no one says, because cars crash, we should do without cars. Because government leaders lie or steal, therefore we shouldn't have any government leaders. But why is it that everyone has such a particular thing to vent against religion? Ultimately, they are protesting a supreme controller. And the big demons, of which there are none today, the Asuras today, and those under their sway, there's so many innocent persons who are under the sway of Asuras, they're so small time, as Srila Prabhupada pointed out. Krishna doesn't need to come to rid the world of them. Just a tsunami or an earthquake or a flood, finish. So the underlying belief, this Asarika Bhava, it's much more small time today than as so eloquently and vehemently expressed by Hiranyakashipu. These days, you find that subconsciously, many people resent the idea that there can be a supreme controller who can reach into any aspect of their life as he likes. I've heard some person say even, the thought is nauseating. To think, in my life, it's like my privacy is invaded. It's like people protest against the government invading privacy. They can find out where you are by your mobile phone, and they can
stick a GPS device under your car and find out wherever you're going. You never know. Especially in the USA, they really get agitated about that. So then to think that there is a supreme witness who can just peer into every aspect of your life. The current Asarika Bhava protests against that. Can't tolerate that. It's my life. What I believe is up to me. My conceptions are all up to me. My desires are all up to me. Just like my consumer choices are all up to me. It's freedom. How can there be a supreme controller that is allowed to just stick his fingers into every corner, dark corner of my dirty heart? The thought just repels me. It's against individual freedom. It's like little children protesting against the parents' discipline. Why do I have to have parents telling me what to do? I'm 5 years old. I know everything. I can provide for myself. I have my toys. Who knows more than me? Why does mother and father have to tell me what to do? Leave me to my own devices. I'm 5 years old. This is the talk of those childish, misguided persons under the influence of the current Asarika Bhava. They don't have the guts and the gall and the powers of a Hiranyakashipu or Hiranyaksha. They're not nowhere near the caliber necessary for Krishna to come and deal with them. They're just so tiny, so small time. They cannot order their own affairs, and yet when they hear about a super soul in everyone's heart, a Parameshwar, they resent that. Just as in the battle of Kurukshetra, when Krishna, through various ways, intervened, similarly, in this situation, Krishna is intervening. He's encouraging Arjuna to kill Ashwatthama. There should be no mercy for him. And we hear that Arjuna didn't like the idea of killing him. Although he was the abominable murderer of Arjuna's family members. Once again, we find Arjuna demonstrating restraint and very fine qualities, just as he did in the first chapter and the beginning of the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. He's very reflective. His Ishwar Bhava that Kshatriyas have, his controlling tendencies are totally under control and disciplined by integrity, thoughtfulness. Krishna was urging him on. Finish off this abominable killer of 5 sleeping babies. Beheaded them and took their heads on a plate and presented them to his father, Dronacharya, thinking his father would be pleased. At first, his father was Ashwatthama's father. Ah, these are the heads of the enemy warriors, the Pandavas. But then he discovered that these were the heads of the 5 sleeping babies of the Pandavas. He was horrified. Why should Ashwatthama, the murderer, be spared? Especially when Krishna himself is saying, kill him, give him the justice he deserves.
And Arjuna did present the murderer to his wife because he had vowed, I'll get him and we'll punish him and you'll be able to, when he's beheaded by me, you'll be able to take your bath standing on his head. The debate will be, on the one hand, Ashwatthama has done such horrible things, such abominable things. On the other hand, he's a member of a Brahmana family, although he's a disqualified Brahmana, and also he's the son of the Pandava's military teacher. Should he be killed? Should a Brahmana, even a so-called Brahmana, should he be killed, even though he has done such horrible killing himself? So Krishna is, as we see in today's purport, he's urging Arjuna, kill him, kill him. Although Krishna knows, of course, that this is a kind of delicate situation. But Krishna wants the whole world to see Arjuna's powers of calm deliberation and deep thinking in the most emotionally intense situation you can imagine. Now, you thought the beginning of the battle of Kurukshetra was intense and challenging. Senyo ubayo madje, ratams, I made chuta. Drive my chariot in between the two armies, achuta, infallible one, so I can see who's there, what their fighting mood is. And what happens when Krishna indeed, serving his devotee Arjuna, drives in the middle of the two armies? Arjuna looks around and the impact suddenly dawns on him, the full impact of what a civil war is all about. He's a seasoned warrior, yet there's never been a battle like this in which friends and relatives, former comrades, former teachers and their students, they're all on opposite sides. So this full impact suddenly hits Arjuna. And he starts to waver. On the one hand, you could say his wavering is the sign of fine qualities. On the other hand, the codes of dharma for kshatriyas firmly prescribe certain responses to aggression. And there's no doubt that the Kauravas, headed by Duryodhana, were wrongfully aggressive. Even Krishna himself tried to arrange for peace, but the Kauravas, Dhritarashtra and his sons, they wouldn't listen. Faced by the immediate prospect of a civil war, both armies are already in position. They're just sizing each other up, assessing each other before the clash starts. But just the sight of friends, relatives, persons who know each other, arrayed on opposite sides, about to kill each other, this overwhelmed Arjuna. Also, it's Krishna's arrangement. Krishna wants to show what it's like when someone becomes overwhelmed by a material situation. And this happens to us all the time in our sojourn through the material world. We get overwhelmed by intense situations. What to do? Oh no, how did this happen? This is generally the way life in the material world goes. Any happiness
is actually an exception to this constant problem.
Oh no, what to do?
But then we have some moments of so-called happiness and we really latch on to those moments.
Ah yes, this is what it's all about.
No, it's not all about that. As long as spirit soul is in contact with matter, there's a problem. There's a foreign situation. It's an artificial situation. Even our thinking, feeling, and willing, which seems so natural and so intimate with us, it's actually perverted. It's artificial. It takes some humility to understand that our thinking, feeling, and willing in the conditioned state is unnatural and distorted. Generally, in material life, we take our thinking and feeling so seriously. It's my thinking, my willing, my feeling. That's me. It's what being me is all about. And you want others to take your thinking, feeling, and willing so seriously. When that doesn't happen, you become so upset. Where is that person who will take my thinking, feeling, and willing to be supreme? And in that, it's the most important thing in life. So then your heart longs for someone who will consider your thinking, feeling, and willing as the most important thing in the world. And you feel so empty-hearted when such a person is not around. You feel lonely. So then you look for friends, you look for companions, partners, because you want your thinking, feeling, and willing to be taken so seriously. You want it to become dear to someone. Let my thinking, feeling, and willing be dear to you. When actually the pure spirit soul has nothing to do with this materially expressed thinking, feeling, and willing. The energy is coming from the soul, but the result, because of the interference by the three modes of material nature, the result is something distorted and artificial. Indeed, our very sense of identity has become disrupted by the material energy. And so an amazing thing has happened. The pure spirit soul, through the medium of the false ego, thinks itself to be material and subject to material reactions. And therefore, the conditioned soul aspires for material happiness and is constantly fearing material distress. The questions there in the third canto of Bhagavatam asked by Vidura to Maitreya. Pure soul is always pure consciousness and never out of such consciousness, whether due to circumstances, disarrangement, that arrangement. How then does the pure spirit soul become implicated in nescience, in illusion? We are not independent. Krishna is the only Swarat, the independent entity. We are always dependent. We are potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and we can be overwhelmed by another potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, by the arrangement of the Supreme Potent. Even in such an extraordinary situation as the spirit soul being overwhelmed by the material energy can happen by the arrangement of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. We are not the supreme controllers, and we resent that often. Why is this happening to me? It can happen to others, but why should it happen to me? I think I explained before, when I was visiting Keynes, and there's one devotee doctor couple there, and they were explaining to me what the reaction of so many persons patients who are terminal cases. Because, as you know, in Australia, there's very little religious sentiment. People don't blame God because God thinks about God. It's not a subject that's on anyone's mind, if you're not saying. Think about rugby or Aussie rules or something like that. God. So what happens? They were telling me when people are in their terminal condition, who do they blame? You have to blame someone. They blame the government. Why didn't the government have proper medical care to stop this situation? What's wrong with the social welfare system? I'm dying. Why didn't the government have sufficient medical technology in place that they could have detected this 20 years before? I'm paying so much money in taxes for this whole system, and now I'm dying. How can this be? So there's no question of the resentment going toward God, because God, what is God? But the resentment has to go somewhere. In the Battle of Kurukshetra, some person, when they read about it, when they read about the Battle of Kurukshetra, they resent. What is Krishna doing this and that? What's Krishna doing there in the first place? Oh, you say that Krishna's God. Why is he meddling? I was once doing a program in Sydney at a wealthy Indian gentleman's house, and he had his relatives there, near and extended. And so I was speaking about Krishna, and right in the middle of the lecture, one of his elderly relatives starts interrupting me. Why are you speaking about Krishna? You don't know. I know. I am from India. I know what Krishna has done. He cheated in the Battle of Kurukshetra. He took out his wives. He did this. He did that. How can you talk about Krishna? What could I do in this situation? He was publicly blaspheming Krishna. I couldn't just be quiet. So I had to battle with him. And in the end of the battle, he shut up. I was thinking, what kind of Hindu is this? Then, after the program, his brother-in-law came up to me and told me, don't mind him. Yeah, he's from India, but he's Catholic. But, you know, in the Western world, Catholics, they're generally very open-minded. They're quite metal. They're not fundamentalists. But he felt he was specially empowered to challenge any mention of Krishna. And that, how could I know where Krishna really is? I'm from India. I know Krishna. He did this in the Battle of Kurukshetra. He did that, and you're here glorifying him. So he resented the whole idea of Krishna having anything to do with this world. In other words, if he's really God, he should just mind his own business and be quiet. That kind of God we can tolerate. But this kind of activist, proactive God, we don't want it. But to speak of a God who has Ras Leela doing all the things we want to do, we don't want that kind of God. If there is going to be a God, he should support our own Ras Leelas. But he shouldn't have any. He should give us good romance, he should give us good money, and he should be poverty stricken and have no associates and no intimate affairs. That's the kind of God we could tolerate. But what this idea of a anumanta upajasta, a witness and overseer in everyone's heart, that's just too close to home. It's just it's very intimidating to know that Krishna's in your heart, seeing what you're doing all the time. It's an invasion of privacy. So in to start the battle of Kurukshetra, Arjuna, had such a difficult situation to consider. And we find out that Krishna himself arranged that situation. Krishna wanted us to be able to see what it's like to be in Maya. So he had Arjuna actually succumb to his Maya. A real life example. Remember in the first chapter how Krishna smiled seeing Arjuna's change in between the two armies? Why was Krishna smiling? Srila Prabhupada gives some insight. Krishna was smiling, thinking, just see the power of my Maya. Arjuna's right on the chariot here with me, and he's falling into Maya. Just see how extraordinary my illusory energy is. Krishna wanted us to see a first-class example of what it's like when you identify with the body and mind and start wrestling with decision-making in that kind of consciousness. This is the agony that Arjuna went through. And such a dramatic example of a breakdown. Just looking at the situation from an external point of view, psychologists today who read Bhagavad Gita, they say it's a first-class description of breakdown, psychological breakdown. All the symptoms are there. Of course, we know that the situation was arranged by Krishna for our instruction. Now, after the war is over, Krishna is still doing things for our instruction. He's instigating this Ashwatthama predicament. Kill him! Kill him! Look, don't you remember what he did to those sleeping babies? But what Krishna really wants everyone to see are the qualities of his devotee. He's glorifying Arjuna. It's not like Krishna is testing his devotees so they'll fail. The same thing in Battle of Kurukshetra. Krishna is arranging for Arjuna to be glorified, as well as Krishna is arranging for our instruction. So therefore, Arjuna became bewildered by the will of the Lord. And they go from the two of them, Arjuna and Parthasarathi, Krishna, they go from universe to universe putting on this show. Again and again. Often we think that tests from the Supreme Personality Godhead are meant to intimidate us, throw us off the track, going back to Godhead. But actually, these tests are for bringing us closer to Krishna, and in the case of thick and thin devotees like Arjuna, therefore magnifying his great quality so everyone can see. As Prabhupada writes in the purport, but Lord Sri Krishna put to test many of his pure devotees just to magnify the sense of duty. The gopis were put to such tests as well. Prahlad Maharaj was also put to such a test. All pure devotees come out successful in the respective tests by the Lord. So it's not that Krishna is trying to fail his devotees. Let me see how much trouble I can give my bhaktas. In Bhagavad Gita it says, only by devotional service can I be understood. Only by devotional service can they come to me. Now I will just shake the ground under them and make it so difficult for them to attain me. Now that is not Krishna's mentality. He wants his devotees to be glorified. He wants the whole world to see the glory of his devotees. Of course, in the beginning stages of devotion, the illusory energy has the thankless task, as it's described, to test devotees, to see who's sincere or not. This is all part of personalism. Wouldn't you wish that you had some kind of personal secretary who could vet any persons who want to deal with you and test their motives? Wouldn't that be very convenient? Isn't it such agony in this world to deal with persons who you thought you could depend on and they let you down? They had ulterior motives for being your friend, even your husband or wife, they had ulterior motives. And then when you find out later, it's the greatest agony. Psychologists have pointed out that the greatest agony in this world for people is not so much physical disease, but the agony produced by other living entities. Mistreatment, abuse, duplicity, deception. It just drives you crazy. Why did that person do that? Why? Why? I gave all my trust. I did so much for that person, and now I've heard that they're talking about me in this way, or they did this, they did that. It drives people over the edge. So wouldn't it be so convenient to have an energy that vets persons and tests them to see what their real motives are? It saves you so much anxiety. Krishna, as Parama Purusha, the Supreme Person, has such an energy. So the task, the service of the illusory energy, is to make sure that insincere persons don't approach Krishna and disturb him. So not only does Krishna have an entourage, he's never alone. Even in your heart, he's not alone. He has his associates there. Similarly, Krishna has his energy for vetting persons who approach him. But for those thick and thin devotees, those tried and true devotees, like Arjuna, Prahlad Maharaj, and of course the gopis, there's no question of Maya testing them. What Krishna is doing is personally expanding their glories. When apparently Krishna left the gopis and then rejoined them, and they were questioning him, because some of them were disturbed. Why, Krishna, did you do this? We gave everything to you. What kind of love is this? This was their pure devotional service to Krishna, for some gopis to be a little disagreeable. But they presented it in such a beautiful way while massaging his feet. They're squinting at him. Could you tell us, can you answer a few questions, please? What kind of love is this? That the lover does certain things. So Krishna explained that actually I never left you. I was from a hidden place watching to see your topmost ecstasies in love and separation. I wanted to see that. Not only did Krishna want to see that himself, but he wanted the whole world to know. He wanted all of existence to know of the insurpassable love of his dearmost devotees. So that's a different kind of test than what the illusory energy does. Krishna's testing of his closest devotees, those devotees who have established themselves in his trust, that test is simply to demonstrate their glories. That's all. Therefore, as Prabhupada writes, all pure devotees come out successful in the respective tests by the Lord. Bali Maharaj was put in such an excruciating situation by Vamanadeva. He lost all the three worlds in a few moments. What happens when we have something? Our mobile phone or something, and we lose it. Bali Maharaj lost all the three worlds in a few moments. And then, what did Vamanadeva tell him? You haven't completed your promise. You promised me three steps of land. I've only taken two. What could Bali Maharaj do? He said, well, the possessor of the wealth must be more important than the wealth itself. I've lost the wealth, but the possessor's still here. All right, my Lord, put your third step on my head. But still, Vamanadeva pointed out, you didn't keep your promise. Now you must be bound. So Bali Maharaj was bound up by the ropes of Varuna. Very painful situation. But it wasn't the physical pain of being bound and captured. Bali Maharaj, the greatest of Kshatriyas, it wasn't the physical pain that was affecting him so much. The humiliation. You've owned the three worlds, and now you've lost it all, and then you're just bound up, exposed like that. And then his own wife came along in this situation and chastised him. You thought you were the supreme controller. Now look at you. This is the greatest pain. So you might say, why is the Lord doing like this to his own devotee? Bali Maharaj is one of the Mahajans. 12 authorities in devotional service. He's the epitome of surrendering everything completely to the will of the Lord. No, actually, the Lord is broadcasting the glories of Bali Maharaj. And at the end of this Leela, what happens? The Lord himself says, I'll go with you and become your doorman. Bhakti is beyond material conception. How can persons who are so averse to the presence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, they can't tolerate the thought of any interference in their life? How can they understand such leelas? First, there has to be some purification to dispel this spirit of intense resentment. Why is Krishna meddling in Kurukshetra? Why is he meddling with me? If there's a God, God should simply fulfill my desires for enjoying this world. That's it. And since there are problems in this world, since there is evil in this world, that shows you there's no God. In other words, the function of God is to fulfill our material hopes for material happiness. If that's not happening, apparently, that means there's no God. So we look at all the problems in the world. We look at what the Bala Kurukshetra, Krishna doing this, Krishna doing that. Even now, he's meddling in this situation about Ashwatthama. We can't have this. It's actually a demoniac attitude. It's not innocent. Innocent people are misled by such attitudes, but the attitudes are not innocent. So we can think about how Krishna deals with his devotees, both in the beginning stages and in their perfect stages. And we can get a full sense of, indeed, how we are never separate from Krishna. And Krishna knows how to deal with his parts and parcels. in all stages of their existence.
All right, any questions?
Comments, Holiness Bhanu Maharaj?
Would you say the test of the non-intimate devotees would be karma?
That's a question. It's a Bhanu Swami question, and only Bhanu Swami should answer it. So please, you ask the question, you please give the answer.
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah. In the Bhagavad Gita says that the devotee himself thinks that if it's a test, it's a test of karma, because it's his own creation, his pain and his whatever he gets in the material world. He doesn't accuse Krishna of doing it.
Mm.
So that part of his existence, that part he considers a test.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? Mm. But the other test of Krishna for that devotee would be that in spite of all that, problems caused, he doesn't consider that really Krishna's responsibility, but rather the test actually is that he continues his devotion in spite of all these other things. But he doesn't blame Krishna for that part of it, the karma part of it. Whereas for the materialists, they don't have any faith in God anyway, so there's no test in that sense. The test is simply that sooner or later, if they get frustrated with their material position, then they'll surrender to the Lord. So in that sense, the test is simply that then whether they're going to keep on blaming someone else for their misery or else surrender to the Lord.
Thank you. Anything more? Yes.
In the case of Ajamil, like, if he was put into test or he was fell into
sense gratification? Ooh, Ajamil, a delicate case. The acharyas explain that actually his fall down was accidental in. I also heard Prabhupada explain like this. He was a Paka Brahmana boy, but he happened to see a scene that these days would be considered, you know, kid stuff. He was doing his devotional duties for his teacher and for his guru, and on his way back to the ashram, he saw a man and woman embracing, and he couldn't get the thought out of his mind. And so later he went and found out who was that woman. She was a prostitute. And even though at that time he was actually married to a qualified Brahmana girl, he just left all that and took in the prostitute and even started committing crimes to support her. So the explanation I heard Srila Prabhupada give was that Ajamil was like held up at gunpoint by material nature. So then, naturally, devotees around Prabhupada, when they heard him explain like that, he was speaking very softly and not like, in other words, we shouldn't take such explanations and apply them in some kind of loose way. It's a deep subject matter. And so devotees ask Prabhupada, well, okay, if that's the case, if Ajamil was accidental fall down, then how do we know how to judge devotees whether the fall down is accidental or not? And Prabhupada said practically in a whisper, only I can tell that. There's another example in Los Angeles in the 70s. A devotee did a very, well, devotee, we say, we
tend to use that word very generally, by the person's activities, if they weren't acting as a devotee, did something very abominable. And so devotees were presenting to Prabhupada. Well, in Bhagavad Gita it says, Pichet Sudara. Yes. You know, he's a saintly person, even though he did such an abominable thing. That verse doesn't apply to neophytes. Maybe Bhanuswami can comment more about Ajamila.
We can say that he wasn't actually a devotee, so he was just a Brahmana, and his dharma was not enough to protect him from the modes of material nature, which is always a test anyway. So this is the test of Maya in the material world, and for your adharma you get karma for that, or your dharma you get good karma for that. So this is more or less the test of Maya itself in the material world, to make sure the person is following properly. So it wasn't Krishna's direct test, that much. But the purpose of the story is to show that by accidentally naming his son Narayana, that he could remove all of that bad karma simply by accidentally chanting the name of Narayana. So even if it wasn't his good fortune or something, or his punya to say the name Narayana, that was accidental more or less, so that even that had effect to destroy all of his karmas. So the idea is, in spite of all of our karmas and all of our, misdeeds and temptations and fall downs in the material world, if we, without aparad, accidentally chant the name, then we can also get free from it. That, of course, is not the highest result of chanting the name, since prema is the highest thing, but it does even accidentally destroy all karmas. So that's the whole idea of the story, that how do we counteract karmas in the material world? But that was the question asked, and the answer is that the first answer given by Sukadev was you do jnana and austerities and all punyas and counteract with atonements or prayaschittas, and Prakriti wasn't satisfied with that. So that the best means of counteracting karmas is, of course, chanting the name even in an accidental form, because the karmis don't have bhakti anyway, so accidental chanting can do it. But then the idea is that if you do it with the idea of atoning for your karmas by doing simple activities and then chanting the name, then that becomes an aparad. So it has to be completely accidental in that case. So that's going to say the mercy of the Lord to save the most fallen people, even by accidental chanting. So there is remedies supplied by the Supreme Lord in the material world for people who are very sinful, to counteract their crimes, and their suffering. So this is one of the ways in which the Lord provides. So he's not, in that sense, indifferent to the people of the material world. But this way is actually accidental, so it's not that everybody gets a chance.
You were mentioning Sukadev Goswami's answering the question of Prithvi Maharaj, how will people be free from all this karmic entanglement? You've described how they can please tell me how they're going to be free from this hellish suffering that you've described in the fifth canto. So I was just reading in your presentation of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary, where he says he lists that as one of the tests that Sukadeva was testing Prithvi Maharaj.
Yeah.
How do you do it? Well, by karmic activity. One karma cancels out another karma. Testing Prithvi Maharaj for our benefit. What would you say?
Yeah. Well, as I said, it goes both ways. Prithvi is asking the question, but he also wants the answer, obviously. But then Sukadeva also tests him by giving the wrong answers.
Just wrong answers in the Bhagavatam.
Now your doubts can escalate.
That person knows, so he's not satisfied, so he rejects the atonement, you know, he rejects the jnana, you know, renunciation idea, and then he comes to the idea of even a shadow of bhakti in the form of, you know, accidental chanting is enough to destroy your parents. Let's speak of real bhakti.
Kachik Kevalaya Bhaktya Vasudeva Prime. Just like the first rays of the sun dispel all the fog, similarly, just a little bit of bhakti can dispel all our sinful reactions, although that's not the ultimate goal of bhakti. All right. Hare Krishna.